Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of October 26th, 2012. And I hope you are hungry, because today's show is all about food.
You can go to some of the Chinese or Vietnamese or Salvadoran or Cuban and get a full, delicious meal for less than the price that you pay for a Big Mac and fries.
Take that, dollar menu. Pulitzer Prize-winning restaurant critic Jonathan Gold helps us find the best food deals. Speaking of cheap eats, could you feed four people for five nights with just $50?
You basically just have to have the guts to kind of go up to the butcher and say, hey, I know that this is going to look ridiculous, but could you just cut a pound off of that?
And of course, it's Halloween. Plenty of Americans spend wicked money on candy corn and caramel apples, but not all treats are edible.
There's probably well over $1,000 now spent on equipment.
Okay, all that and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts designed with convenient features to help reach savings goals. To learn more or open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
This week on the show, one of our favorite subjects, certainly one of mine, food. We're going to talk about where our food comes from, what we like, and most importantly, how much it costs. The problem of tracking down healthy, filling food for a relatively small amount of money is a perennial one. If you stick to the basics, you can probably keep your costs down. But anyone who's ever tried that knows you can often end up sacrificing two key ingredients, variety and taste. Robin Bashinsky is here from Cooking Light magazine. He's a recipe tester and developer who took on the challenge of preparing five tasty and varied meals for a hungry family of four on a budget of just $50. Robin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So what did you end up cooking?
Well, we came up with five dishes, and we did sort of a Northern European thing with the mussels. We have a Thai noodle bowl that has chicken in it. We have a slow-braised pork shoulder served with grits and tomato gravy and greens.
You're making me hungry.
You have a pizza that was fresh mozzarella, roasted tomato, spinach. Then we ended up with an Indian dal that we cut off some of the pizza dough the night before and made a flatbread to go with the Indian dal, which is a very aromatic spice lentil and rice dish. So basically tried to mine a bunch of different culinary traditions for variety and keep it cheap.
Right. You mentioned two meats there, a pork shoulder and chicken, which people might think would be cost prohibitive because they're not cheap, but pork shoulder, if you're going to get pork, is one of the cheaper cuts, right? And you use chicken thighs, right?
Chicken thighs, which are gaining some momentum in the market every time I go, but they are still probably your cheapest chicken option.
Yeah.
And so then the pork shoulder, it may seem a little costly because it's generally sold in about 6-pound chunks, but that's enough to feed a family of four for a week on its own. So you basically just have to have the guts to kind of go up to the butcher and say, hey, I know that this is going to look ridiculous, but could you just cut a pound off of that? And usually they're very kind and don't mind.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that because I think that is something that becomes a little awkward, you know, if you want, you know, a piece of a flank steak or you want, you know, a portion of a chicken breast or something like that. But that's what the butcher's for, right?
Exactly. And some of the more expensive stores, Whole Foods is the one here in Birmingham.
Also known as Whole Paycheck.
As known as Whole Paycheck,
right,
for sure. But, you know, you can buy teaspoons of spices,
right,
a half cup of dry rice, a 3/4 of a cup of dried beans, which is going to cost you literally 32 cents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to give you an example, like the spices I bought, they wouldn't even register on their scale, and the manager just came over and was like, just give them
wow
to him. So,
nice.
You know, if you have a nice manager, you can actually end up with stuff for free, maybe. But so that was actually a surprise that maybe that something that is perceived, like you said, as Whole Paycheck, they offer plenty of items that you can buy in bulk and buy on an as-needed basis. And truly, I mean, if you go and buy a jar of cumin or ground coriander or something, it's anywhere between $4 and $7, and it's going to go gray and stale, and you're going to end up needing to buy another one before you use the one you have in your pantry already.
Right.
So
for our listeners who might want a similar challenge, what are some of the best you know, cheap filling foods that they can look for at the grocery store?
Well, like I say, chicken legs.
Yeah.
Both in drumstick and thigh form, whichever you prefer. I would say the bulk bins as far as grains and beans, depending on how you sort of manage the dispenser, some of them are kind of rigged to where it dumps out about 2 quarts of rice. You know, all you're wanting to do
right.
is just sort of get enough for your family, and then you've got enough for the church picnic. I mean, one of the things that we featured was a couple of markets, one of which was an Asian specialty market,
mm-hmm.
and then also a farmer's market. There's deals to be had at both of those places. I would say ethnic markets in general are a good place. If they stock it there, it's cheaper than wherever you're normally buying it. I can promise you that.
Do you think what you accomplished is doable pretty much anywhere? I mean, you know, I imagine that Alabama may be cheaper than a lot of other places in the country when it comes to food. Is that the case?
No, it's not doable everywhere, I would say. But I think that one of the things about Birmingham is that it's pretty average for America. It's, you know, kind of middle America, yet we're in an urban environment, so things are more expensive here than they would be, you know, 60 miles from here. So I think that it is a good indicator for the majority of the country. And I would also say if you live in one of those cities like San Francisco, New York, Chicago, you're probably used to having to overpay for everything anyway.
Right.
So don't get too disappointed when it costs you $70 to do this instead of $50.
I can vouch for that. All right. So you had a budget of $50. You ended up spending $48.48. Would you like to share mm-hmm. with us what you spent your last $1.52 on?
Well, it was a tall boy, as we call them in the South, a 16-ounce beer to steam the muscles in. And I bought it at the Quick Mart on the way home at the gas station.
Love that.
I've got that much, and I knew that I only needed one. And, you know, there's a lot of places that'll sell you individual craft beers for $2.50, $3.50, $4.50, whatever. But, you know, if you're going to be just steaming muscles and putting some seafood flavor in there, all you need is a Miller High Life.
I love it. All right, Robin Bashinsky is a recipe developer and tester at Cooking Light magazine, and we'll have a link to his article where he fed 4 people for 5 meals on $50. We'll have that on our website. Robin, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And if you're interested in seeing a comparison of how much food your dollar can buy you today versus 10, 20, even 30 years ago, we have a calculator at marketplace.org. Americans spend, on average, $151 a week on food, according to a poll conducted in July by the folks over at Gallup. They had not asked that particular question since 1987, when the average was $106. But adjusted for inflation, we're actually spending less money on food than we used to. And while most of us eat at home most of the time, we do enjoy a meal out every once in a while. And with that in mind, we decided it would be an excellent idea to talk food and money with someone who eats for a living.
Most of what I'm looking forward to is the iced coffee here, which isn't the best in the world, but it's good enough.
That is Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. A few weeks ago, we asked him to drive with us around L.A. County, home to more than 20,000 registered food establishments, and show us how to find the best food at the best prices. Jonathan Gold, welcome to my car.
It's a nice car.
Thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to our adventure here, trying to see what we have in the way of cheap but delicious eats around Los Angeles and perhaps what folks can look for in their neck of the woods.
Right. I'm not sure they're going to find exactly this in their neck of the woods.
All right. Well, we are still in the car because we are about to go through a drive-through, but this is no McDonald's. This is not even In-N-Out.
We are going to a place called Lee's Sandwiches, which is a branch of a Vietnamese sandwich chain that serves something called banh mi.
Tell us what's in it.
It's a baguette. There's actually a neon sign in the window flashing hot baguettes when they come out of the oven, just like the hot donut sign at Krispy Kreme. That is slathered with liver paste, a little bit of mayo. There's 3 or 4 different kinds of charcuterie, usually roast pork, some chashu, and then herbs, including, you know, cilantro, maybe a couple of Vietnamese herbs, pickled carrots, and sliced jalapenos. It's one of the really great sandwiches.
Well, I'm glad I didn't eat breakfast today.
Some people say it's the one good thing that ever came out of 100 years of French colonialism in Vietnam.
All right, shall we pull in?
Let's do it.
Welcome, Lee Sandwiches. May I take your order, please?
At that point, I let Gold take over the ordering process for me, our production crew, and his 9-year-old son, Leon, who joined us for the lunch tour. Gold has been eating his way through Los Angeles since 1985. For this lunch hour, he picked a drive-thru in San Gabriel, a city east of Los Angeles, where 60% of the population is Asian.
When people talk to me, they always like to say, oh, okay, what's your favorite drive-thru? Thinking that I can confess to a longing for Big Macs or something. And I always tell them about Lee's Sandwiches, because in Los Angeles, you can drive through and get a bun mi. You don't have to get a filet-o-fish sandwich.
Well, so while we're waiting at the window, you know, if you want to eat well, but you don't want to spend a lot, where do you go? I mean, at least here in Los Angeles, it seems like the natural place is ethnic food.
I don't like to use the term ethnic food, because everything, I mean, American food is ethnic food, too.
True.
We just never refer to it that way. But you want people who are cooking the food that they make themselves. That way they don't have to pay the processing costs for the big plants. That way, presumably at least, they're cooking the food that they themselves eat and they're good judges of, and the food's actually going to be better. You can go to some of the Chinese or Vietnamese or Salvadoran or Cuban or whatever restaurants, not just in L.A., but anywhere in the country, and get a full, delicious meal for less than the price that you pay for a Big Mac and fries.
Why is that?
It's because they're eating food that's, if not all locally produced, just as close to being locally produced as possible. There's obviously no waste when you're going to a fast food restaurant, but there tends to be no waste here either, because they tend to use every part of the animal. And you don't have the big overhead of the corporate infrastructure to maintain.
And with that, our food came through the window.
This is going to be a little messy, but don't worry about it.
That is delicious. And our producer, Joel Patterson, is in with us. And you want to tell us what we just spent?
4 sandwiches, 3 iced coffees, $16.55.
That is a bargain.
That is a bargain.
Later in the show, soup dumplings at the Great Mall of China.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank, FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts with a competitive variable interest rate and convenient access via phone or web. Link your existing bank accounts without switching banks. To learn how this FDIC-insured high-yield savings account can complement your savings goals and to open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
Last week on this show, we heard all about genetically modified ingredients in our food. Now, if GMOs scare you, you are probably inclined to shop at your local farmer's market. For that, and plenty of other reasons, including how amazing food from that market tastes. And going locavore is also a way to help support sustainable agriculture. But it's a movement that Pierre Desrochers claims could have negative implications if taken too far. He's co-author of The Locavore's Dilemma in Praise of the 10,000-Mile Diet. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing a lot over the last several years about the need for us all to become locavores. This whole notion of like a 100-mile diet is what you should strive for. And I tell you that that has made me feel quite virtuous when I go to the farmer's market every week.
Well, good for you. But then you've got to ask yourself, if things were so great in the past when people had the de facto 100-mile diet, let's say 3 centuries ago, why did so many people work so hard to develop the globalized food supply chain in the first place?
Well, give us the arguments then against locavorism.
Okay, well, there are several, but let's look at the environmental dimension, which is the one that is usually put forward by a local food activist. And so the less food travels, well, obviously, the more the food is produced locally, the less we will emit greenhouse gases in the process. But what several studies have shown is that, well, the food mile is a good indicator when everything else is equal. But in the real world, not everything else is equal. So why, for example, do we import fruits, let's say apples? Where I grew up in Quebec, apples are ready to be picked in September. So what happens when you want to eat them in March or April? Well, I mean, you need to put them in cold storage for several months. This requires a lot of energy. Then you end up losing a number of apples to spoilage. But it so happens that in the southern hemisphere, be it New Zealand, Chile, Argentina, South Africa, seasons are inverted. So their summer are our winter and vice versa. So their apples are ready to be picked in many locations in March or April. So you then put them on a container ship, which is by far the most energy efficient mean humanity ever developed to move things around. A container ship floats, it uses powerful diesel engines, it burns so-called bunker fuel, so the lowest grade liquid fuel that we have. And a couple of weeks later, these apples are delivered to your local supermarket. So in the process, you've saved months and months of storage, you have almost no spoilage.
But I think part of the locavore movement and argument has been that, you know, maybe you shouldn't expect to have apples 12 months out of the year, and that we should be moving more toward eating seasonally.
Okay, well, then let's go back to when people were eating seasonally, how enjoyable there was their life back then. And so in the book, for example, we discuss the diet of European agricultural workers in the early 19th century. So if you happen to be a German peasant who was living seasonally year-round, mostly around local food, you would eat peas and lentil for almost all of the year and then get a few fresh things around harvest times.
Okay, I'll admit that doesn't sound terribly exciting.
Well, but that's the thing. And over the last century, you know, things really began to change in the 19th century. And what happened over that century and a half when we stopped to eat seasonally? Well, we grew several inches as a species. We lived much longer and healthier lives. I mean, life expectancy at the turn of the 20th century was 47 years of age. We have less diseases. We don't die of many other things that are related to malnutrition.
You go so far as to call locavorism a marketing fad. I mean, it's right on the jacket of your book. You really think it's just about marketing? I mean, why not have a movement where you're supporting local farmers and, you know, even people in your neighborhood who maybe have an orange tree or something like that?
Well, the problem is that people tend to forget that famines and malnutrition historically were only really defeated for the masses when long-distance transportation came along. And so people would regularly starve because when you depend entirely or mostly on your local food supply, you will not only have good years, but a fair number of bad years. And historically, two bad local harvests in a row and you had a famine.
So is your argument that if we continue down this path of locavorism, that ultimately that will somehow injure the rest of the food supply industry? I mean, why not go as locally as you can and then let the rest play out?
The problem, as we see things, is that ultimately this will result in even more agricultural protectionism. And this, we argue, is a really dangerous path to go down to. I mean, you might have heard the old saying that if goods don't cross borders, armies eventually will.
So me going to the farmer's market on Saturday means that what, Canada's going to invade?
Now, this means that, unfortunately, the road to hell is paved with good intentions and that the extra bucks that you're spending buying lesser quality local food, unfortunately, will not help the earth, will not help the local economy, and is part of a broader movement which we think, carried to its logical conclusion, can be very dangerous. We're not against good quality, appropriately priced local food. We're against local food that has no other attribute than positive attributes than being local.
Can you give me an example of what that would be?
Well, again, for example, I teach at the University of Toronto, and a lot of people really hate me there because I've been vocal about not encouraging the university to buy Ontario-grown produce when we can get cheaper produce from California. Believe it or not, I've had the courage to stand up for California strawberry on my campus. We still do produce some strawberries in Ontario. But you see, but that's the thing. We can get very good quality California strawberries for about a third of the price of Ontario strawberries. So if we end up spending millions of dollars more on the food every year, that, you know, that we offer at a discount at the local cafeteria, well, that's less money for the gym, that's less money to provide more parking space or bicycle stands or things like that. So this is why we argue this is a really silly idea.
Pierre de Rocher is a co-author of The Locavore's Dilemma in Praise of the 10,000-Mile Diet. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Time to hit the road again with Jonathan Gold, restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. Now, this is a guy who gets to dine at LA's finest establishments on someone else's dime. But he's even more well-known for his fondness for and deep knowledge of the city's hole-in-the-wall strip mall mom-and-pop eateries. So when we asked him to take us on a gustatory tour of cheap eats in LA, our second stop was what's known as the Great Mall of China and a restaurant called Wang Qing Ji.
Wow, it's not crowded. Good, how are you? Take five.
There is only one other Wang Qing Ji restaurant, and it's in the city of Wuxi, outside of Shanghai. The restaurant's front window screams, "Juicy dumplings!" And that is what we are here for. I asked Gold to order for us again, placing check marks on a printed menu. Gold's 9-year-old son also knew what to ask for.
So what's your favorite dish there, Leon?
Some of their dumplings are good, and they have some good meats.
That all sounds awesome.
Meats and
Jonathan, I'm going to let you order.
Oh, and they have, like, this giant dumpling that it's, like, you put a straw in it since it's so big.
You put a straw in the dumpling?
And it has a lot of soup. It's pretty good.
He wasn't kidding, giant dumpling. A beautiful mass of soft dough filled with crab and pork and a golden broth that went far beyond any definition of soup. And it had plenty of company on the table.
All right, so describe for us what we have here.
This is the spare ribs that are like simmered in a dark sauce.
Oh, they're beautiful.
That's a cucumber with garlic. And over there is the smoked fish, that's another famous dish from the area.
Oh, good Lord. I think we're going to have some leftovers. You know, if you decide to go and eat in these kinds of restaurants, how do you know where to start? I mean, there are hundreds to choose from, at least in most of the big cities. You know, like if you go to Minneapolis, how do you know which Somali restaurant to go to?
If I go to a city I haven't been to before, I mean, I'll try to triangulate, I guess. I'll look at the reviews from the local papers, and I'll look and see what kind of online things there are. Not that I necessarily will trust a single review from Chowhound or Yelp, or even a predominance of opinion one way or another on Chowhound or Yelp, but it will give you some idea of what they have.
So you actually read those sites?
I look at them. It's hard not to. The one great thing about Yelp, and I'm not a great lover of the site, but the one great thing about it is that probably for the first time ever, if you're going to a Taiwanese restaurant in Hacienda Heights that specializes in a certain kind of noodles and has a teenage clientele of Chinese, then you can actually read the opinions of Taiwanese teenagers or Taiwanese-American teenagers, as opposed to having somebody like me, you know, a middle-aged white guy, going in and looking at the food from a completely different perspective.
Hmm.
And Yelp also has this odd feature where you get a gold star for first-to-review. And because you get a gold star for first-to-review, you find people going to sort of every place that might possibly serve food.
Because they want the gold star.
Because they want the gold star. And they may not have any idea of what they're eating or why they're eating it, but the fact that they're there, they're putting something of their impressions online, could give somebody who's looking for directions maybe a clue that there's something there.
Well, I know you already have a Pulitzer Prize, but I certainly hope you have a few gold stars on Yelp.
Oh, I... if I did, I wouldn't tell you.
We ate our way through an extraordinary table full of food. The final bill was a little over $100, so about $20 per person. More than we paid for banh mi at the drive-thru, but we also had a ton of food left over, which prompted this bit of advice from our critic.
When you're taking home leftovers from restaurants, that's something you always have to ask yourself. Am I going to be pleased to see this tomorrow morning when I'm taking out my eggs for breakfast? And if the answer is no, leave it.
Unfortunately, we did leave it in the car on a 98-degree day while we drove around the city. We did not have it for breakfast the next day. Coming up later in the show, we visit a low-cost dining establishment that you cannot escape in L.A., the food truck. And now time for your letters. We'll call that perhaps food for thought in this segment. I'm joined by our senior producer, Patty Hirsch, and our very good friend, David Lazarus. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Tess.
Anybody bring cookies? We're talking about food.
Oh, I didn't know that we had to BYOC.
I brought cookies, but I ate them on the way in.
Oh,
you would.
No.
You would, yeah.
You didn't share with the whole class.
It's selfish. What can you say?
I'm just glad to be here because my understanding is there's like some news of import hanging over our heads right now in a Damoclean fashion.
Oh, what is that?
We're not going to be able to do this together much anymore, you and me.
Oh, no, we're not. In fact, this is probably our last moment together.
Oh, stab me again, Tess.
I'm sorry.
Do I need to clarify for the listeners what's going on here?
I think so, because I'm too broken up.
All right, so the word has been out in the Twitter sphere and the face place for several weeks now, but we may as well broadcast it today, Tess.
I will be leaving Marketplace. This is my fourth to last show. So three more.
11 years.
That's a lot of personal finance, yes.
Yeah, and, you betcha.
At this point, I wish that I had taken more of my own advice.
I suppose so. And you are sorely going to be missed around here.
Oh, thank you, David. I appreciate that. I'm going to miss our listeners more than I can say.
We'll just have a moment of silence here.
Yeah, I know. If that doesn't put a pall of gloom over the show, I don't know what will.
All right. Well, in that case, let me cheer things up a little bit.
Yeah, why don't you?
Some listener letters, maybe.
I would love that.
Okay. So many listeners wrote in to comment on our segment on genetically modified foods and the dangers of GMOs.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, they wanted us to point out that testing on GMOs is still going on.
And indeed it is.
Right. Watch the space on your Doritos packaging for details.
Oh, no.
At least here in California.
Speaking of spaces, we had a lot of comments about tattoos. Some people love them. Some people hate them. Where do you stand on tattoos, David?
I'm just not a big body art kind of guy.
No.
You only get one set of skin, and I just don't want to mess with
and,
it. But
and, of
me.
Course, what we were talking about last week was the effect that it can have on your employment potential. So.
And I know a lot of people with tattoos who come to rue the day.
Yep.
But a lot of people wrote in to say, to give advice about how to deal with tattoos. But David, who wrote in from West Lynn, Oregon, to comment.
That's my hometown.
That's your hometown?
That is my hometown. That is where I grew up.
Well, David wrote
Hi,
in
David.
From Tessa's hometown. His advice, never get a tattoo where the judge can see it.
Oh, that's good advice.
I like that.
That's good advice.
I like that.
All right. A couple of questions for you, Tess. Linda from New York wrote in. She said that she's looking for a debt counseling service.
Okay. And credit counselors. Okay.
Credit counselors. That's the National Foundation for Credit Counselors. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. That's where you go to find a good...
Accredited
yeah. credit counselor who can help you, hopefully, with a debt situation.
Right. There's a lot of fly-by-night types with that kind of thing out there, and the smart play is to go with the accredited ones and don't pay money up front
yes.
for this sort of thing.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, so we'll have that link on the website for you. And Joan from St. Paul wrote in, she wants the name of the fee-only financial planning association that Jill Schlesinger recommended a few weeks back.
If I remember correctly, that was the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, NAPFA. That's NAPFA.
And now some questions for David. We had several letters asking about avoiding the deluge of credit card applications that anyone with a half-decent credit score seems to get these days.
Mm.
How can you avoid this stuff?
The best way is you go to, now write this down, kids, www.optoutprescreen.com.
And oh, dear Lord.
That optoutprescreen.com, that is the service. It's the one-stop shopping service offered by all the credit agencies.
Okay.
And if you go there, you can sign up both for a five-year opt-out and a permanent opt-out from receiving any credit card solicitations. But heads up, you're going to have to give your Social Security number to do this.
Mm.
This is one of those rare occasions where I would say it's worth it. Normally, I would say you don't give your social to anybody. But if you're like me, you don't want to receive these solicitations. I have found this to be helpful.
That's good. All right. Well, that's great information. Thanks, David. We'll have all of that on the website. Another question for you. Jeffrey from Maine wants to get his son, who's a high school senior, a credit card. But it seems really hard to do this because while banks seem keen to offer college students cards, they don't seem to offer the same kind of credit building opportunities to high schoolers. Any ideas?
Yeah, this is a great question, too, because it really addresses the at what point do you want to introduce your kid to the world of credit?
In fact, we've actually talked in the past. We've talked with people who wanted to sign up their
2-year-olds. Yeah.
Too young. That's a red flag. But teenage years, I mean, you got a handful of choices here. And the first one is obviously a prepaid card. It's kind of like a debit card.
Right.
Not a bad choice. Not a great way to build up a credit history, however,
right.
because it's not going to really do anything for you there, although you do have more controls. Another choice is you can do a joint account. Essentially, you're going to be the co-signer for your kid. And that's not a bad choice because you can get a card with a low credit limit, so you have some controls. Also, it allows Junior to build up some credit history doing this. Mm-hmm. The trick is when and if your young one gets into some trouble, do you bail that person out? And I would say no. One of the things here of the learning experience is teach them how to deal with a financial mess on their own. That's part of the thing. So that's what a joint account is good for. And then your other option is you can make your teen an authorized user on your card. And that's a possibility as well. Now, that puts your credit record on the line because if your teen starts becoming a scofflaw when it comes to plastic, that's your FICO score now.
Right.
That's going to take a beating. On the other hand, it's the fastest way to get a kid into the world of credit. And if you've got a rewards program with your card, your teen spending is your reward.
Right.
It's just a little something.
For better or worse, right.
And it seems to me that don't let your teenager become a scofflaw. I mean, start talking about how credit cards work and what it can mean for them down the line if they don't pay on time and if they go over limits. I mean, it should all be a conversation that's going on, well, far in advance of getting the credit card, but certainly at that point.
I agree. And every time you get the statement as well, that's a teachable moment.
Education. Talk about this stuff, people.
Have you ever considered a career in radio doing this kind of thing, Tess?
No, you think I'd be any good at it?
You're awfully good at it.
Well, thank you, David.
You
I
might
really
want to think on
that.
You know, just kind of a, okay. You got a future, is
okay.
What I'm saying.
I'll talk to a career counselor.
Well, I'm going to break this up now. Okay, it's enough of this love fest. We're out of time here. David, thanks very much for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
And thank you, Patty.
It's always a pleasure, Tess. Thank you.
Face to face with food every day, from the supermarket aisle to leftover cake at the office. But we can't always take that food at face value. Understanding what we eat and what goes into the cost of what we eat takes a little digging. Tracy McMillan is a journalist and author of The American Way of Eating. She went undercover to get a better sense of where this country's food comes from. Her assignment took her to work as a produce clerk at a Walmart in Michigan. She found it tough to eat well on what they paid her. Tracy also spent time as a server at a Brooklyn Applebee's, where she was shocked at how little fresh food was found in that kitchen. But her story as a farm laborer here in California is perhaps the most eye-opening. She joins us to talk about what she learned working on industrial farms. Tracy, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
What prompted you to delve into this question of whether it's possible for those on the lower end of the economic spectrum to eat well?
I personally felt a real disconnect when I would hear sort of, you know, my friends in Brooklyn talking about going to the farmer's market and spending all this money on heirloom tomatoes. And mm-hmm. But also, you know, my background as a welfare and poverty reporter. So I spent most of my work life, you know, meeting folks in welfare centers and public housing projects, and they cared about their food, but just, you know, they weren't going to go spend money on heirloom tomatoes for the most part.
Well, set up for us how you started out this experiment.
Sure. So basically, you know, each time I moved to a different workplace, I gave myself, you know, the startup fund by minimum wage for 1 month. And then I would sort of, because I was spending 2 months in each job, you know, I would really have to be living off my wages. What ended up happening was that, for instance, in the fields in California, housing costs end up getting split among so many people in one house.
Yeah, in fact, you ended up living with 17 people at one point.
Yeah, I was in this little two-bedroom sort of bungalow, and so there was a family of 7 in one bedroom, a family of 4 in the second. I had a cubby off the living room, and then there were 4 or 5 guys living in the garage.
Now, the first third of the book, you are in these fields. You picked grapes, then peaches, and then garlic. None of them seemed to be terribly pleasant experiences. And you ended up basically running out of money to buy food for yourself. How did that happen?
my sense of how to budget for food was still really based on, you know, a relatively middle-class experience. If you're working field labor, you actually eat 4 meals a day because you eat at 4 in the morning when you get up. You eat at 9 a.m., which is lunch in the field. You have dinner at, you know, 7 o'clock at night, and so you've got to have some sort of afternoon meal. And I didn't really calculate that into my plan. And so what I would end up doing is just getting so hungry that it became irrational and would, like, run to the local bakery. You know, I never told anybody that I was a journalist, as far as everyone knew when I was doing the work. You know, I was just a really broke white girl.
Mm-hmm. There's a scene in the book where you talk about what is essentially a food pantry out of the back of a pickup truck. And one of the points that is being made here is that, you know, this is one of the few times where these workers who are basically around fresh food all day, but this is one of the only times when they can actually get some of it themselves.
Right. Particularly in the community I was living in, you know, there was one grocery store, not a great produce section. Most of it's relatively expensive. So when you go to, you know, the food pantry giveaway, what you're able to get are these, you know, beautiful fruits, you know, which might be near turning, but, you know, you get fresh fruit and things that are more of a treat for families.
And the other eye-opening element of that first third of the book that startled me was how much cheating is still going on in terms of what workers are paid versus what they worked.
Right. That was really shocking for me, too. I think that if, you know, I'd had somebody interview me in depth before I started the project, I would have said, I'm sure farm work is really hard and you don't make much money. But to me, not much money would have still meant minimum wage.
Right.
And what was happening instead, right, is I was getting paid $1.60 for every 5-gallon bucket of garlic I could pick. And, you know, on a day when I picked 10 buckets, the company, even though we both had proof that I had been there for 8 or 9 hours, gave me a check saying that I had been there for 2 hours.
And what was frustrating to me as a reader who tries to be cognizant of these issues when I go shopping was that, you know, even a company like Christopher Ranch, which is well known as one of the big garlic distributors and is sold at Whole Foods, that they use a middleman that engages in some of these practices.
Right. I mean, it's incredibly common in produce harvesting to use a farm labor contractor. They take care of all of the paperwork and they take on all the legal responsibility for hiring that workforce and making sure the work gets done. And what that means is that, you know, the growers don't really have to know what's going on very much.
What frustrates me after reading your book is that I kind of feel like I'm actually a bit helpless in trying to change the system. It feels very hopeless.
Yeah, I definitely feel you on that. For me, what's been really interesting is to come to this realization that expecting that the way we will change and fix the food system is by everybody making better individual decisions,
mm-hmm.
that's actually not going to do it, right? Because what we need to do, if we want Americans all to be eating healthfully, we need it to be easy for them to do it. I feel like a lot of the discussion over time has been, you know, about you should go to the farmers markets, which, by the way, are only open for 5 hours every Saturday.
Right.
Right. Or you should be cooking everything at home from scratch, you know, 5-6 nights a week, which is, you know, difficult for a lot of people. How do we make it easy for everybody? We need to be demanding things from our politicians, you know, to give us a food system that feeds us well.
Tracy McMillan is the author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And on a side note, in a couple of weeks, we'll have a special show in partnership with The New York Times talking about how to bulletproof your personal finances. We'd like to know what you think. Send us your ideas for ensuring financial security via Facebook or on Twitter or by way of marketplace.org. And now to our final installment of Holy Cow, Amazing, Delicious, Cheap Eats with Jonathan Gold, restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. We spent a couple of hours with him a few weeks back, driving around the eastern portion of L.A. County for the most delicious and affordable roving lunch I have ever had.
We visited a drive-thru that serves Vietnamese banh mi sandwiches, and then a soup dumpling house. And after that, where else? A truck. Okay, now we have moved on. Tell us what neighborhood we're in.
We are in Boyle Heights, which is a section of East Los Angeles, or the east side of Los Angeles.
Okay, and we're about to eat at part of a phenomenon that really hit it big, I don't know, what, 2-3 years ago? This is basically a culture in Los Angeles.
The idea of trucks or lunch trucks. There's the new wave lunch trucks, of course. The places like Kogi or the Lobster Truck, where you go and you have fairly elaborate, quote-unquote, gourmet lunches. Places that accept credit cards, some of them places that, you know, tweet their locations.
But these taco trucks have been here way longer than that.
Yeah, these are the loncheros, which a phenomenon that actually started in Los Angeles in the 60s, you know, spread across Mexico and has been well established in Los Angeles, obviously, for a very long time. This truck here, Mariscos Jalisco, is notable for a few reasons. One, at the LA Street Food Fest, it tends to win, like, almost everyone it enters. This truck has been here for almost parked in the same spot for 20 years. The guy who owns it lives in the housing project across the street. He has a couple of different meat tacos, but the thing that almost everybody gets is his specialty, which is deep-fried tacos filled with shrimp.
If we must.
I know I'm imposing on you, but...
You are, really. I'm only doing this for the story. Yes, you heard that right. Deep-fried shrimp tacos.
You prepare 3 tacos? Yeah.
You want one?
5?
5.
Yeah. No, be 5.
So 2 Cokes, 2 waters, 5 tacos.
Your taco will come out right now.
Okay. Well, what do you make of the whole truck phenomenon? Is that a passing fad?
The truck phenomenon is here to stay, I think. And the reason I like it is because it's entry-level capitalism. It's an incubator of cuisine. So if you go into a truck and you have a really great idea and it catches on, the first thing you get is gigantic lines, and you're able to make that money that way. And if it ends up being, like, really popular, then you can open a restaurant or any number of restaurants because you've already developed your concept.
Thank you. Oh, this looks divine.
Here's a lot of napkins. Pardon my crunching. These are hard to resist.
Wow. So, given your specialty, and this is a lot of what you write about, are you just philosophically opposed to paying a lot for a meal?
Of course not. I love extremely expensive food. To tell the truth, you know, there is an immense amount of pleasure to be gotten from a $500 seafood meal at Providence, and there's an amazing amount of pleasure to be gotten from a $1.50 taco in East Los Angeles.
And there are plenty of places where you have to pay a lot of money where you don't get that pleasure at all.
No. Back when I was a music writer, I was talking to this singer named Ian Mackay, who was in a band called Fugazi, still is. And I was asking him why he only charged $5 admission to his concerts. And he said that it was because it gave him the freedom to be who he was. He couldn't understand why people would pay $150 to go to the opera, and if the opera was terrible, they weren't outside with pitchforks and torches waiting to light up the tenor. And it's the same way with restaurants. If you pay $400 for a meal, that meal had better be perfect in every single way. If you're paying $1.50 for a meal, it probably has more of a connection to the person who's cooking it. It has more of a connection to the people who are eating it. And what might be considered privation, which is, say, sitting here on this squat wall in East Los Angeles, actually becomes a feature instead of a bug. It becomes something that's delightful. We're liking being out here in the shade of the ficus trees.
Well, Jonathan Gold, this has been an extraordinary tour. I thank you for joining us at this lunch hour.
It's been a pleasure.
Bon appetit. Of course, we cannot talk about food at this time of year without mentioning candy. Americans are spending more than ever on Halloween this year, about $80 per person, according to the National Retail Federation. Jeez, really? Well, okay, a third of those surveyed said they're actually cutting back on the sweet stuff to save money. So pat on the back for you. Your teeth will thank you as well. But for some of us, apparently, the fright spending never stops. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains the growing hobby of ghost hunting.
Most of us prefer a peaceful sleep. But Michael Valentino took a 3-hour trip from New Jersey to the tiny town of Napanock in upstate New York to spend the night in the haunted Shanley Hotel. On purpose. Like he paid for it.
Today's my birthday. I just turned 30. I wanted to do something that I've never done. So I was online and I found this place. I'm like, this is great. I want to do this. This is awesome. And we booked it.
Yeah. That sigh is courtesy of Chelsea Pearsall, Valentino's girlfriend. She's less excited about the paranormal possibilities of the Shanley.
I'm trying. I can't be the lame girlfriend.
Do you believe in ghosts?
No.
But you seemed a little scared?
Definitely.
You hoping to have an experience?
No.
Pretty much everybody else is hoping to have an experience. The Shanley charges guests $85 per person. For your money, you get a haunted room, a historical tour, and equipment and guides to help you ghost hunt late into the night.
This Joe's room, this is his actual chair, okay? When men sit in a chair, if you feel your arms kind of getting tugged, he basically wants you out of the chair.
If you think spending $85 to see a ghost is a lot, you should meet a serious ghost hunter.
This is a full-spectrum camera. That's my newest toy.
Willie Hassel has been tracking the paranormal for 10 years.
The infrared spectrum and the ultraviolet, which you can't see with the naked eye, this camera will pick up the whole thing.
Hassel leads a team called Spirit Chasers Paranormal. He estimates he spent around $900 on ghost hunting equipment.
When you get hooked, like anything else, you start spending money.
Fellow spirit chaser Michelle Hamill says she's gotten pretty hooked herself.
Oh, we got the game cameras. We got the digital cameras. We have the K2 meters now. We have more voice recorders than I want to admit owning.
Do you spend a lot of money on ghost tracking equipment?
Of course I do, but I won't admit it to any friends or family. There's probably well over $1,000 now spent on equipment.
It might seem strange to spend money trying to see a ghost, but more and more people are willing to pay, says Sal Nicosia, owner of the Shanley. Nicosia says these days most of his guests are first-timers in their 20s and 30s who've gotten curious after seeing reality ghost hunting shows.
New people, never done this before. And it gives me a satisfaction when they experience something, see the expression on their face that there is something there.
One of our team members just had something very interesting happen here.
The Spirit Chasers team is gathered on the third floor of the Shanley in one of the unrestored rooms. Michelle Hamill looks like she's just seen, well, you know.
I'm walking down. I'm looking room to room. I saw a dark, tall person waving.
Which should be easy to capture on all of that expensive equipment.
But unfortunately, we did not catch that on camera.
But later that night, Hassel says he did get a recording from Joe, the grumpy ghost in the chair, telling him to get out. How did the amateurs do? No hard evidence, but Michael Valentino and Chelsea Pearsall did get a feeling in one of the rooms.
It's like a lead blanket where, like, you get weighted down, like you're about to be shocked with something.
I actually felt that in my spine.
It's really freaky. I can't explain it. I have no idea.
The payoff for ghost hunting. Bad feelings, mysterious dark figures, angry voices, and, of course, a good ghost story of your own. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
That is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Tess Vigeland. Next time, payday lending is the scourge of most personal finances, so why would anyone defend it?
The best way to help cash-constrained households during times of financial emergency is to give them as many choices as possible.
An argument in favor of payday lending. I can't wait to hear that one. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Thomas, and Mary Dew. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace general manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.